This is the Good Things Guy podcast with myself, Brendan DeCube, South Africa's very own Good Things Guy. I'm on a mission to change what the world pays attention to. I truly believe that there's good news all around us, and I spend my time hunting down and reporting on the best good news stories from South Africa and the world. In the Good Things Guy podcast, you'll meet these everyday heroes and hear their incredible stories.
Welcome back to Good Things Guy, where today we're going to be interviewing Dr. Floris Berger, who we've had quite an interesting offline discussion about how he has a new respect for doctors after getting COVID-19 and being in that space. Dr. Berger, tell us a little bit more.
Thanks for this opportunity. I think what I would like to add before I start sharing my experiences, I consider the frontline everyone that dealt with me. From my first exposure to a organization that tested me right through to when I was released and the post-hospitalization care I'm receiving. So I think I would like to touch on all of those to say that the professionalism, and I will probably conclude with that after my story, the professionalism and care and empathy that I was treated with from the day I tested voluntarily up until today. I think I would like to share my experiences regarding my whole and the month and a half of exposure to people dealing with COVID patients.
Super. So, Dr. Berger, what sort of symptoms were you showing that you went to go get tested?
None whatsoever. I traveled for business via Kenya. I stayed over a full flight, and then just add. So sitting in economy class, full flight, nobody wearing masks. That was now 2 months ago. But I wasn't concerned because at that time, South Africa wasn't even talking about lockdown. Stayed over in a hotel in Nairobi, had a stopover in Accra and Liberia on my way to Sierra Leone, spent there a week in Sierra Leone after traveling in a full vehicle for 7 hours, 7 hours back, another 9 hours on the airplane, stopovers. So I said to myself upon return, there were a lot of international travel of passengers on the airplane, and I said, what's the chances of me having the virus? And I said, probably very good, no symptoms whatsoever. The Monday, 3 days after, I returned on the Friday, the last flight out of Sierra Leone. I need to add, I probably wouldn't have had this chat with you if I didn't make it out in time. No symptoms. But Monday, I went for the test at Ampath. That was my first exposure. I'm not nervous at all. They treated me very, they probably thought I had symptoms. They didn't ask me. I just showed my passport and the travels for the past couple of weeks. And they said, now I'm definitely eligible for a test.
So no fever, no cough. No, like none of those symptoms that people are saying that they get from this.
Not a single symptom. And I could have picked it up only 3 days prior or 10 days. I wouldn't know. I had no symptoms whatsoever. I felt good. But like I said, as a precautionary, I thought, let me just go and get a test. The next day, that's the Tuesday, the pathologist called me. First, she informed my GP of the result. She called me personally and said, Flores, you're positive. And I said, what should I do? I wasn't anxious at all because I was, in a way, said to myself, I'll be very lucky if I didn't pick it up. Like I said, even on the flight back, they tested our temperatures at the airport, which was checked a day before admission. It was normal. I had slight symptoms the 3 or 4 days after I tested positive.
And what kind of symptoms were those?
It was really just headaches, and I felt a bit tired, and I lost appetite. But I was okay. I was functioning okay and a bit hard-headed. I said to my friends that said, first, you need more attention. I said, but I spoke with my GP and he advised me what to do, prescribe some medication. And then if I can fast forward, I ended up in the hospital because the previous 2 days I've got no memory of. And wow. I would like to share that. I think the medical fraternity talks about happy hypoxia. So the oxygen levels in my blood started to drop so significantly in the 2 days before admission. But I have no recollection of the previous 2 days, none whatsoever.
And did anybody close to you say that you started acting strangely or anything?
My friends called me because they know I'm positive. I informed my twin sister and one or two close friends that I'm positive, but I'm feeling okay. And the general advice is rest and to check your temperature. Rest and drink a lot of water and wait for clear signs of fever. That's 2 months ago. And you know how the world has changed in 2 months. I mean, the list of symptoms are now very clear and expanding every day, as you're probably aware of. So the first hero I want to share, absolute hero, was the Department of Health. They called me, apparently, I've got no recollection, they called me on the Saturday, a day before admission. Now, I was told this afterwards, of course. She called me, and the sisters, the nurses called Sister Mongezi, apparently called me on the Saturday to confirm my next of kin and to confirm which seat I sat on the airplane to South Africa, because she assumed I was probably surrounded by more South Africans. And I apparently had shared the correct information with her. Then the Sunday morning, this, let's call her a frontline nurse for the sake of, because she's dealing with a fresh COVID case. She sat there and she went through a list of calls the previous day. And she said, this florist I spoke with yesterday sounded incoherent. Let me call him again. Just out of her own, it wasn't protocol or the procedure that she needs to follow up every day. She called me 5 times and I didn't pick up. I was fully awake. I didn't hear the telephone ring because my blood sugar, I mean, the oxygen in my blood was already so low that I was semi-conscious in a locked door, alone at home. And she was aware of that. So she immediately, after the fifth time of trying, this is, I mean, I've spoken with her and I was probably the most emotional I was after I was released. I called her up and I said to her, you saved my life, sister. But back to the chronological events, she then called the hospital, the closest hospital, and said, are you ready to receive a COVID patient? He's semi-conscious. She arranged for the ambulance, which took hours because it's not all ambulances were certified to pick up COVID patients. Wow. So a friend came, waited for them outside, then knocked on my window. I didn't react, but I was awake. At some point, they wait outside my door for 10, 15 minutes, obviously suited up like Ebola nurses. And then they were able to attract my attention. I opened the door. I said, what's this? I was totally confused. And they just said, Flores, you're very sick. We've arranged for you to be admitted to the hospital. They put me in the ambulance. And from then on, I can't recall anything. So if it wasn't for that nurse that called me on Sunday, the physician said I would have peacefully passed away Sunday night. Wow. As simple as that. I would have lost consciousness. So that lady I want to meet one day. And even as I share with you now, I feel emotional. Because she literally, I'm not taking credit for going for the test. This is the human nature of these nurses. She cared enough to say, let me just give this guy a go. Not once, 5 times on Sunday. And then she acted. And before she called my next of kin, she arranged to check the closest hospital to say, I'm repeating, are you ready for a critical patient? And they said, we're ready. The ambulance came. They explained to, because I was resistant, not obstructive. I just said, but I'm okay. But they know. They know this guy doesn't have enough oxygen in his brain. They just put me in and relaxed me and said, just relax. And then I passed out. The next amazing experience was, apparently I walked into the hospital myself because just parts of my brain were fed oxygen. And the physician said, all right, how do you feel? I said, no, okay. Your temperature? I said, no, I don't know. My temperature wasn't checked, but it was checked. So they took my temperature. It was fine. They said, well, let's just check this guy out. They took x-rays and they saw my lungs because I've got a comorbidity of hypertension, which is under control because of medication. But obviously when the virus grabs hold of high blood pressure bodies, you know, it's like the super Uber for the virus. So it just accelerated the pumping of blood through my veins into my lungs. So when they looked at the x-rays, they realized if I'm not intubated immediately, they will probably lose me. But credit to the let's call them the frontline, people dealing with an infected person. They had a person on literally in the theater to intubate me. They had the neurologist there. They had everybody on standby. And then I guess within minutes or half an hour, I don't know. I was put under anesthetic or induced coma. They intubated me so well that then I'm jumping here to release. I had to see the throat specialist last week, and he said they did a massive job because there was no damage to my vocal cords. There's obviously muscles that need to recover, but somebody that's been with a pipe in their throat for 18, 19 days, there's usually quite significant damage.
How long was the pipe down your throat actually?
I was intubated, or the pipe was down my throat for about 18 days, but I was in the induced coma for 14 days. And every time they tried to wake me up from around about day 9, but then if your lungs can't respond spontaneously, if you want to call it that, then they need to increase the anesthetic again. So, because then your heart rate goes up, it pumps more blood. Blood clots started to form. So a lot of blood clotting took place, so they had to treat that. So they did an absolutely heroic job because it's pure life support, and they realize every day beyond day 5, 6 becomes very, very, very critical. So the internist, everybody on the team, the physiologist dealt with me that I can only assume that clinically a fantastic job, because here I sit, I've got no, I'm very positive the way they treated me. I'll get to the later stages, but the way they clinically, whilst I was far, far away, they must have done a best in the world job. When I was woken up or weaned out of the induced coma, I was tied to the bed because 99% of patients will pull out the pipe from their throat. That's a natural reaction, even if you heavily sedated. But I was able to communicate with my one hand, and every time I indicated, you know, they must come closer, I want to write, they came in and they spoke with me and they calmed me down with so much empathy and calmness. That's what I recall, because they realized if they can't tell me the truth, because I will overreact, I guess. They just said, "Flores, you're all right." Even if my vitals were critical, the hand signals always calmed me down. 24/7, I was being monitored visually and then in terms of the vitals that they were monitoring. So I've got three groups of heroes now, that the Department of Health that said, "No, we're taking over. This guy doesn't know what he's doing." Then the proficiency of the intubation, and then that fight beyond day 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, just to, I don't want to call it experiment. That's a disservice to their trade. But they just say, we're not going to lose this patient. We're not going to lose this patient. So, I mean, that's the next group of heroes. And then the ICU staff, they apparently, I was very obstructive, and they've never probably had this case. And they asked for new protocols to handle very obstructive patients, but I was in heavy sedation, so I take no blame for that. But they had to deal with me on a psychological level and a clinical level. And the recollection I have was one of absolutely perfection. Maybe I'm filtering out the negative, but I'm not. Hopefully not.
Yeah.
That was the next group. The ICU staff, I'm not sure if this analogy makes sense, but I guess they looked at a adult, but they treated me like a 3-month-old baby. If that makes sense. You know, yes. With absolute softness and soft voice and patience. And they spoke with me, even if they realized I can't talk. I mean, I had the pipe in my mouth. I couldn't even write most of the time because I was tied to the bed. So that was a real, to me, it made me, people ask me, did it change my life? Was this a life-changing experience? And I said, no, I wouldn't have known if I didn't make it. But one thing I've realized is that the inherent empathy and goodness of the human being astonished me. I mean, these people, you can argue they're doing their job, but they're doing it brilliantly. And after day 9, 10, they can easily lose faith in their own abilities, isn't it? But they persisted. The ICU staff treated me consistently with patients. Sometimes when I was lightly sedated, I realized I'm probably frustrating them. And they never had a body language of frustration or irritation. So full marks to them. After they extubated me, I was moved to another ICU room. And then I started dealing with the more day-to-day ICU staff because I wasn't in a chamber anymore. And that was quite amazing as well. When anybody walked in my room, they asked me, how do I feel? And I said, no, I feel fine just seeing you. Because the way they treated me, again, are you all right? You feel comfortable? When I pressed the little alarm bell, they're there in a minute. And again, they treated me with empathy, with care. I could perceive from my ignorant perspective, total competence. I mean, they had to check on me every hour, right through the night. Again, they tried to wake me up like a baby. Were very patient because then again, I was obstructive. I took out the oxygen pipe from my nose. You know, I didn't wear mask or switch off the alarms that were going off. You know, so I was quite out of control at some points. And never were there any impatience from anybody. So I really felt as if the whole hospital were behind me, if that was possible. Yeah, so, yeah, and then I would say the competence, the openness and honesty, I would like to add, from the physician that treated me, they were straight with me. They realized when they weaned me out of the induced coma, they can't tell me how bad it is. But really, a couple of days later, they were very clear with me to say, you were critical, you need to relax, You need to keep your heart rate down because these are the risks. And every time when they did a sonar and they picked up blood clots, they were open with me. They said, Fleuris, there's a slight, they didn't even call it, it wasn't really a complication. There's a slight delay in your release. We need to put you on antibiotics for a couple of days. Relax. We've seen this before. It's normal. They never tried to, I won't say traumatize, but to upset me. But I think they were honest enough to not withhold critical information. And I would like to add the way they treated my family as well, the front line, because they had to, my twin sister were on their backs every single day for that month for feedback. And it was honest. It was sincere. It was with empathy. When people, I mean, still call me from the hospital, whether it's the physiotherapist or the receptionist at the physician, and then they're emotional. So, I mean, I think that to me, again, back to what did I learn? I learned the massive ability of the human being to care for somebody. And I'm not more deserved than anybody else, is it? So I'm convinced that that's just the nature of the frontline and the medical fraternity to say, our job is to make sure this person walks out here in the best possible condition. And that I experienced, like I say, from my first exposure with the pathologist when they tested me and post-release now as well. Yeah, that's in short the chronological set of events.
Dr. Berger, it's just the most crazy story. And it's such an honor to get to speak to someone who's lived through COVID-19. I feel like a lot of us feel far removed from it. Like we don't know anybody that has it, or we haven't really heard stories of people that have recovered. So I guess I just have two questions. And the first is, how long have you been home now?
Yes, now about 4 weeks.
And how are you feeling now? Like, how's your mental state? How's your physical? Have you got energy? Are you feeling flat? What is your mental and physical health like now?
Yeah, let's start. I think I would like to answer that in terms of the emotional, the cognitive, and the physical side. Emotionally, I'm very, very well. I don't have bad flashbacks, and when I do have them, they prepared me very well for that. Part of the rehabilitation was one or two sessions with a psychiatrist. They just warned me, even the physiotherapist said, I will slowly recollect events, obviously not during the anesthetic stage, the anesthesia stage, but slowly when my friends say first, but I called you on the Saturday and this is what I said. I slowly recall that. But emotionally, I'm very well. And I think it's just the way I was treated. I don't want to give them all the credit, but I'm positive. I'm very positive. I sleep well. They obviously gave me sufficient medication to calm me down. But emotionally, the only emotions I had is when I think back and I share the story. Now, when I spoke with you and I said, Sister Mongezi, you know, she's the hero. I will never forget her in my life. She will be a big part of a chapter of my book one day. Emotionally, very well from day one. And I think what is nice, they're open for any time telephone call. So I can call anybody there, not any time, but I mean, and say, I'm worried about this or that in terms of the emotional side. So emotionally, I'm very, very fine. In terms of the cognitive, that's still a way to go. Short-term memory is not too good, but that's improving every week.
How old are you, if I may ask?
I'm 57. And like I said, I'm currently jogging, running about 2-3 kilometers every day, hour of resistance training, and then another hour or so of cognitive training, which they gave me to do.
All right. So this is all part of the recovery plan, the physio, the cognitive stuff that all forms part of it.
Yes. And it's really over to, you know, for me to decide. But I mean, if you're responsible, I wrote a letter to the hospital and I think I really meant every word of the sentence when I said, I feel in a way obligated and indebted to the 20, 30, 40 people that I engage with to say, 3 months from now, I've made 100% recovery.
Sure, yeah.
That will be the tick against all the boxes to say they were also the positivity of the whole experience. Don't lose it now, Fleuris. Make a proper recovery. Have a chat with the people in 2-3 months and say, you know what? I'm even better than I was before I was admitted. And that's my drive.
Yeah, doctor, I just think your story is so incredible. It just gives us insight as to what's happening in the hospitals. And yeah, I'm just very honored to speak to you. I mean, this is a bit out there. And, you know, like in the movies, when you see people have these near-death experiences and all of a sudden their whole lives change and they I don't know, they stop working in mining and perhaps become some sort of traveler or change something within themselves. Is that something that you maybe are experiencing or have experienced after this?
Yeah, I get that question a lot from friends that probably wants me to change a bit. But no, not really. I think what I alluded to earlier is the one thing that I was, to me, was a big pivot, was the ability now to actually verbalize my gratitude towards friends and people that care, whether it's the guy cleaning the road or the lady at the till at the retailer. I think that changed. I said to myself, there's more good than evil by far. And evil is not even appropriate word in this interview. I'm still the way I am. I don't think that will change. I'm happy with my lifestyle and my career. But I'm going to sweat the small stuff less. Just be honest on that one. You know, to say, wait a minute, I can lose friends in a blink of an eye. And I think that has changed. I just have that. Yeah, I think that appreciation of the human being's ability, not in terms of only clinical medical proficiency, but the emotional. So, yeah, I care for my fellow human being more, I would say. And I think it's week four. I'm sure it will persist. This was a big enough experience to say this is sustainable. But so, yeah, overall, very positive.
Dr. Berger, I just want to thank you for sharing your story with us today. I think it's given me a lot of perspective. Obviously, to be in someone else's shoes that has been through this makes it less far removed. And to see the humanity and to think about the doctors and the nurses and the people on the front line that are there, that are working every day to keep us safe, is just incredibly inspiring. And I just really, really want to thank you for telling us a story that maybe mainstream media are not showing right now, and making this COVID-19, for me, so real. So thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to recognize the frontline.
They say in times of tragedy, look for the helpers. Those are the heroes that we need to celebrate. And I'm taking away from this that the people on the front line are the people that we need to celebrate. I have to say the next couple of weeks and months are going to be incredibly tough. And I just think we need to be more thoughtful of each other. We need to practice more kindness and maybe love a little bit louder. Wishing you guys only good things.
I'm Brent Lindekew, South Africa's very own Good Things Guy, and you've been listening to Good Things Guy, a Jackpod podcast. For more episodes or to subscribe, rate, or review my podcast, go to iTunes, Iona FM, or Google Podcasts. Be kinder than necessary to yourself and each other. Thanks, and only good things.